Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hello, this is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I've got CJ Martin back on the show. CJ is the owner of CrossFit Invictus and one of the most successful CrossFit coaches of all time. He's worked with a number of CrossFit Games champions as well as team champions. In this episode, we talk all about his evolution as a leader, mentor, and entrepreneur. And it starts out by him telling us about his journey going from being an attorney at a prestigious law firm in San Diego and how he made the decision to jump into the unknown and start his first CrossFit gym. This was the most raw and authentic I've ever heard CJ, and I really feel like I got to know a different side of him. We talk about the highest highs, the lowest lows, including him almost having to shut his doors in 2016. We also talk about mentorship, leadership, coaching, and so much more. CJ is one of the wisest people I know in this industry, and I always love learning from him. So without further ado, please welcome CJ Martin. Hey, before we start this show, I want to let you know about something I'm super pumped about right now, which is that I started a second podcast. It's called the WAG Podcast, and I do it with my wife, Adi Cashew. And the reason that we started this second show is because over the past few years, I've had the opportunity to interview some of the best and brightest in the health and fitness space, from New York Times bestselling authors to Olympians and CrossFit Games athletes to NFL coaches to sports psychologists, you name it, a lot of the best and the brightest. And I have also interviewed my wife, Adi, 6 or 7 times. And without fail, the episodes that get the most engagement in terms of direct messages or mentions on social media or emails are all the ones that I do with her. And I think it has something to do with the authenticity of the conversations, the fact that we know each other a little bit better and can pull stories out of the other. And so we decided that we're going to start a second show. And the format is each episode is 20 to 30 minutes on a single topic with actionable steps after each. We talk about nutrition, personal development, mindset, and fitness. And so far, the response has been incredible. So if you're interested in the conversations that we've had on this show, I know you will love that one. So go check it out. Let me know what you think. Let's get into this episode. CJ, welcome back to the show, brother.
Thank you for having me again.
So we were just talking about how jet lagged you are. As of the time of this recording, you are just getting back from Shanghai. I think they call it the Asia CrossFit Championships. Is that what you just came back from?
Yep, Asia CrossFit Championships in Shanghai. Good time, very quick trip for me. Dealing with a 15-hour time difference.
So I was talking to Tommy Marquez, who was out there, trying to get as much dirt on you guys as possible. And he was telling me that you had to go to, like, there were some issues over there in Shanghai. Yeah. And y'all had to go to a nearby Starbucks to use the restroom. What was the story there?
Yeah. So more for the athletes than me, but the bathrooms did not come equipped with toilet paper, which they did give fair warning at the athlete briefing. And they are also, you know, just a hole in the ground. And so our guys in particular were discussing some different strategies for how far you pull your pants down, because you don't want to pull them too far to the floor.
And, right.
You know, there was quite a technique that went into that. And ultimately, they realized that they could run across to a Starbucks with a hotel in it, and there were very nice, normal bathrooms there.
Amazing. So what was the expectation, that people bring toilet paper with them, or do people not use toilet paper?
Yeah, people just brought toilet paper. So they told everybody to bring toilet paper with you.
Got it, man.
Not sure if that's the standard, but Shanghai was great other than that.
Now, I've always pictured, like, whenever I think about you going to the bathroom, I've always thought of you as one of those guys that that pulls his pants down all the way down at a urinal. So you probably went full pants down strategy, right?
Yeah. How else do you do it?
Right.
I love the lead in, which is like every time I've thought of you, like not that that was a one time occasion, just like all of the times it comes up that I think of you going to the bathroom.
Yeah. Whenever I'm doing these interviews, man, I like to just really think through my subject.
Yeah.
And so obviously I'm going to go there.
It's good. It's just solid preparation.
Right. So I also heard you had a flight canceled on the way here.
On the way out to Shanghai, these are, you know, first world problems, but it was just, I was flying San Diego to LA and then LA to Shanghai. Well, they messed around a bunch in San Diego, got us on the flight late, and the flight to Shanghai left before we landed because of the delay, to which they just say, oh, no problem, we'll get you on tomorrow's, as if that's a totally suitable accommodation. I missed 24 hours, but I didn't miss any of the competition. Got out there Friday night. Competition started Saturday morning. Got to watch all but the final individual event on Monday and then head back to the airport and left Monday night at 6 p.m. and arrived Monday at 6 p.m. So,
gotcha, man. So I think Rasmus went into this competition with a back injury, right?
Yeah, Rasmus had a... Yeah, we don't know the exact extent of the injury, but it's been bothering him for a few weeks. So he was back in Denmark for a little bit. He had to reset a visa and then kind of came back and his back was pretty messed up from that. So we've been training around it, trying to get him a lot of treatment. And he was a trooper, man. He fought through that and did well all weekend. Tommy Venus' back has not been great either. And so it's been fine, except the worm is not his friend on his back. And so one of the events, the deadlift hang power cleans, which in all fairness, it's 120 worm deadlifts, 90, you know, worm hang power cleans.
Right.
It's a lot on the back. So,
yeah, that's brutal, man. So how do you think they performed overall? Were you happy with their performance or what?
No. I mean, honestly, they're just, they're not where they need to be, which is totally fine. Like we weren't going over there to try to peak for this event or anything like that. We knew going in that, that we had a few issues in terms of athlete health and then ability to prepare together. But I think it was necessary to be there because when you qualify in December, you don't compete until August. It's easy to get a little bit complacent around some of those things. And now's about the time that we want them learning those lessons and then really making our final run. And so, I mean, the big takeaways are obviously we got to get Rasmus healthy. And then as a team, we need to work on, you know, the worm and we need to do more team events because in all of the events that were kind of, you know, individual athlete based in other words, everybody had their own section to handle. You know, we took second right behind Mayhem and times should have beat them with some, you know, costly mistakes. And so from that aspect, like I've always felt comfortable with this team. The harder part of that, this team is that we do have, you know, Reagan lives in Oregon. Tommy lives in Arizona. We have to get them together, training together, frequently before games in order to feel comfortable on events like worm or sleds and stuff like that. Because if you're not all in unison, that stuff gets real difficult real fast.
Right. So this is a really new aspect of your coaching process, needing to negotiate people's schedules and coordinate. Can you talk about that a little bit and kind of the challenges that come along with it?
Yeah. I mean, we've dealt with it a little bit in that we, you know, coach so many people online that we've had training camps, so we've brought people out on an individual basis. But when you look at teams and you look at the preparation going into games, they have to be, I mean, a significant amount of those events have used the worm in the past, have used things like sleds where you actually need all four members, you know, kind of getting their rhythm, understanding their timing. And so Yeah, it makes it a lot more challenging this year in terms of teams, because now we've got to make sure that all four of those individuals get to the same place at the same time. Where in years past, all those guys had to be training at your gym anyway. It was real easy season. You knew at the very least from December through August, we were all going to be together. So, you know, the most complicating things are that, you know, Tommy's got jobs. Reagan has a family. And so making sure that we coordinate travel in a way that's sustainable for their life priorities also, that mm-hmm. Reagan's, you know, not missing out on time with her family, that Tommy's still able to make, you know, the income that he needs to make through his career. And so we've just got to be mindful of those things. But this team in particular has known that, obviously, because they qualified in December, they've said, okay, we're going to save a lot of those trips until closer to games, which is why we didn't have a lot of teamwork practice before going out to Asia. But at the end of the day, you know, they did what they were supposed to in all the events that they should have. And then in the worm events, they just took fifth and second, I think. So
right.
It wasn't, you know, a tragedy. They ended up still taking second in the competition. But it certainly pointed out things that we've got to get a lot better at before we go to games.
So Rasmus and Lauren, are they living in San Diego now?
Yeah, they live in San Diego. They live a block from the gym, so they can be there whenever they need.
Right, right. So I would imagine that everybody's fully committed, and the two of them are in Invictus all the time. And I'm curious if you either are currently or foresee having to manage any expectations with them being closer and being able to devote more time in the gym, and kind of weighing that against the fact that the other two just simply can't make it to San Diego as often. Do you foresee any challenges there?
No. I think, everybody knew that was going to be the deal going in. And so that's why we've kind of started to look at the calendar and have planned times in which the team will be together. And then as coaches, once we know that, then we can individually program for them, for their strengths and weaknesses when they're training separately. And then when we know they're going to be together, all of that work is team-based, working on timing, coordination, synchronizing, all of the things that you need to do as a team. So mm-hmm. I think it actually strikes a nice balance. I mean, our other team, Invictus X, qualified out of the MAC, and they're all San Diego-based. And so they just have a huge advantage on things like the worm. But with them, we still have to prioritize their individual training. You've been a member of a team, and if you just train teamwork all the time, you actually can lose a little bit of the fitness that might have got you there in the first place. So there's always sure. that balance and trade-off. We still have to coach the individual athletes on the team, and then we've got to bring them together and then coordinate their efforts as a team.
Mm-hmm. So I've talked to a number of different games athletes about the effect that the changes in the game season have had on them as individuals. And, you know, the experience kind of runs the gamut. Some people are completely shaken up by it. Some people look at it as an opportunity. And I haven't really had an opportunity to discuss this with any very high level coaches. So what's been the impact on you having to manage a bunch of your own athletes individually, as well as an entire online community?
Right. It definitely presents opportunities and challenges, right? The opportunities are the sanctional system gives our athletes more opportunities to compete. And so we have a wide range of athletes from different ability levels. It's nice to be able to see them all able to compete at some level of competition, right? With a regional system, a lot of our guys, you know, our lower level guys wouldn't really get that opportunity to compete at a larger event. So now mm-hmm. they can go out to things like the Asia CrossFit Championship. It's a little easier to qualify into those. So that's a great opportunity for those guys. You know, it's more challenging as a coach because that means we're now preparing people for, you know, 16 different competitions instead of knowing exactly what the schedule is going to be, which, you know, what time their regionals is going to fall. And so our calendaring system has to be a lot more precise and involved on the program design side. It is, I will say it is very costly as a coach to be in this new environment, because we could literally be flying every other weekend somewhere. And especially this April, May stretch is going to be rough, because we're going to go, we were at MAC 2 weeks ago. We were at Asia over this weekend. Both Brazil and Rogue are the 17th, May 17th. So another 2 weeks. And then you've got Granite Games right after that. Right. And so it's like every other weekend now we're flying somewhere to coach athletes.
Wow, man. So you have a really unique perspective in this industry. I think you have I don't know how to say this, but like the greatest combination of A, working with the highest level athletes, but then B, also being so deeply connected to your average CrossFitter. You have multiple locations in many different cities. And I'm sort of curious about what the effect has been on that everyday CrossFitter with these changes. Have you seen any impact on people's motivation, or what changes have you seen in general as a result of these changes?
Yeah, our average member was totally unaffected by the changes, right? Most of them, you know, have a passing interest in the CrossFit Games because they know one of our other members or coaches that has been to the CrossFit Games. But I would say the vast majority of our members aren't like, you know, huge, you know, sport fans. That's not what brought them into our doors necessarily. And so for those guys, it hasn't changed anything. I would say though, we actually saw a membership dip when the changes were first announced. And what it really hit was that middle section, that aspirational athlete that, you know, maybe had a goal of like one of these years, I'd love to get onto a team at regionals or something like that. And a lot of those guys really saw that as kind of gutting that dream, which, you know, to me, whether it's regionals or sanctionals, they should still be pushing themselves to be better and to do something. But we definitely felt it. We had a fairly significant drop off within the 2 months after that announcement, specific to our competition classes that we run at the gym. Everything else stayed, you know, pretty normal. The top end athletes struggled with it, as you said, right? There was a really wide range of kind of reactions to that. Some of our athletes, Kristen Holta, who's, you know, just mentally, she is a rock. She is like the, you know, example of every athlete that I think should follow. And she was like, oh, okay, fine. I'll try to win a sanctional event, or I'll try to win the open or whatever. But a lot of other really good athletes, I mean, top 10 athletes in the world, were really disturbed and not sure how they were going to approach the season. And, you know, obviously that stuff sorts out over time, but it created a lot of anxiety at first.
Right. Yeah. What do you think about this? From my perspective, I think it probably has more to do with the lack of clarity around the future than just simply getting rid of regionals.
100%. I mean, that was my initial reaction. I kind of wrote about right after the announcements happened. It's the lack of clarity that creates anxiety. It's not the changes that create anxiety. It's just not knowing what the changes are going to look like that create anxiety for people.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that. Well, I guess I said it first, but it's funny that we're talking about this. I was reading somewhere. Where was I reading? Anyway, maybe a Sebastian Younger article. He was talking about either Navy SEALs or some kind of special forces. They did some testing on them, and they noticed that as soon as they were told about a specific evolution that they were about to undertake, their physiology would significantly change, right? They would immediately become calmer because they knew exactly what action needed to be taken. And it's such a great lens to kind of look through life at. And it really relates to this, because people just have no idea what's going on. And so this uncertainty is creating a lot of stress and anxiety for people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, and that's very typical. I think most people in CrossFit probably have some type A tendencies, right? And so we can always control, you know, our response if we know what we're responding to. I think it's that element of just not even knowing what direction or how they need to apply their efforts. Mm-hmm. And I think that really showed in training for a while. My view of it, we have some top athletes and I look at their results and they just weren't on par with where they would have been last year. And you could just tell. And even in our physical locations, we just saw our athletes showing up at the gym and they were doing stuff. But man, there just wasn't that focus and intensity until they really knew, which is, you know, frankly, the benefit of qualifying for games early in the process is that those guys know what they're training for, right? Our team that qualified out of the MAC Invictus X, right? They now know exactly what they're training for. We have a full calendar. We know, you know, what we're hitting when we're traveling, all of those things. And that makes a huge difference.
Right. Is there any lesson to be learned for elite athletes? And are there any lessons to be learned for kind of the historically like bubble athletes from this whole evolution?
Yeah, I think, I think there's a lot of lessons. One of the, you know, a very just logistical lesson is that athletes are going to have to pick their season around these sanctional events, right? And you can't say, I'm going to do everyone. I mean, you see guys in a wash cycle of, you know, doing a qualifier every week and then traveling, you know, every month to go to a qualifier, and it's just going to wreck them. I think the longevity of the athlete. So I think the smarter athletes are probably going to pick and say, okay, I'm going to do these three sanctionals, right? And try to spread them out as much as possible and try to create an actual training schedule around that instead of trying to do everything. So that would be one just very tangible. The intangible one though, I think, is that the athletes that I saw least affected by the changes in terms of their mental side of the game were those that had just a really rooted sense of why they do this, right? And the people that do this because they love it, the people that do it because they believe in self-improvement and challenging themselves, and they want all of those, you know, really nice, juicy lessons that you get as an individual out of training, they didn't seem to care. And including those that were maybe bubble regionals athletes that now their dream of going to regionals had been ripped away, they were still able to very easily say, oh, cool, well, I'll train for sanctionals, right? Mm-hmm. I think the athletes who struggle a little more and say, well, I do this for a paycheck, or I do this because, you know, I've got Instagram followers, or, you know, whatever that is, I think it was harder for them because they're saying, well, what happens if there isn't games, or what happens, you know, with all these sanctionals? And so I think they may have struggled a little more, you know, and that's something that we preach all the time. It's like, you've got to be in love with this process because this is a tough sport. And you don't make a ton of money. So if you don't love the process, man, it's going to be hard to look back, you know, and say, oh yeah, that's all totally worth it.
Right. I won't name any names here, but I've heard a number of like very high level athletes. These are all rumors, but the rumors are that some athletes are talking amongst themselves and saying, hey, I'll go to this one. You go to that one, you go to that one. So they're kind of the most competitive people are sort of making sure that they're not competing with each other at these sanctionals. Have you heard of any of this? And what do you think will be the impact of that kind of thing?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that happens. It's going to continue to happen. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing for the competitiveness of the sport. And I don't think it's a bad thing for the competitions. I mean, frankly, these competitions want to attract good athletes. And I think the hardest ones for me are looking and saying, okay, there were, you know, two legitimate competitors at this competition, or worse, right? If there are not a lot of proven athletes at a competition, somebody's still going. Yeah. And, you know, you'd hate to see that. You'd hate to see a really top athlete kind of miss out because they picked the wrong sanctional events, and you know, you show up and Matt Frazier's competing, and you know, Matt's probably going to get that spot. Now they've got this backfill process, but nobody wants to show up to get sixth place and hope that the five guys ahead of them you know, get taken. So, you know, I think you'd avoid that with some sort of point system and, you know, allocating points for different competitions, but that gets super complicated and tricky. So until that happens, I don't see that people are going to let the kind of collusion go by the wayside anytime soon.
Honestly, man, I love it. I've always enjoyed a little bit of shit talking like we see in every other sport. And this is a perfect lead in to my next question.
I know you do.
I like a little shit talking and I just like the whole game. And I think CrossFit grew very organically. And in the beginning, it was almost just like a big family, but I think it was also inevitable that with prize money and sponsorships and an ever increasing level of competitiveness, we were going to get some of this gamification and this kind of working with each other to make sure we qualify. So I really love it.
Well, it just gets, it gets expensive, right? If these mm-hmm. guys are having to fly, you know, so take Brent, for example, right? If Brent decides to fly to Asia and compete out there, right? So we see him out there. But if Pat and, you know, Matt Frazier, you know, a bunch of other guys show up and, you know, now does Brent have to go turn around and try to get to Brazil next, you know, in 2 weeks? And, you know, it's like, so when you hear these guys talking, it's basically like, hey, what's your schedule look like? You right. know, what's your schedule look like? And they just want to know. And at some point, right, they all want to, we wanted, not that we didn't want to beat Mayhem out at Asia, they would have got to qualify, but there's no doubt both of my teams want Mayhem at the games, right? We want to compete against them. Like, one, we've always enjoyed competing against them, but you want to put yourself up against the best. Yeah. And I think some of these conversations are around that, which is, hey, we want to make sure that our best athletes are represented at the CrossFit Games and aren't missing out just because they chose sanctionals poorly.
Right. So I want to spend the rest of the time talking about your arc as sort of an entrepreneur and a leader. But first, before the show, we talked about an Instagram or a Facebook message that you got from, quote unquote, a punk Ute kid kind of talking shit. And I went back, I heard that, and I went back in my Facebook messaging history, and I was like, man, that sounds like something I might do, and I couldn't find anything. But what's the story there? No, what happened?
It wasn't in the messenger. I believe you tagged it. It was like on a you posted.
When is this?
This was, oh man, now you're gonna test my memory on the year. Was it 13? What was your final year on the year?
13 was my last
year. Yeah, 13. It was 13, and you tagged. You sent a post. I think something it might have had like the trophy on it. The affiliate cup, right? Shit. And then tagged all of the members, I think me and all the members of the Invictus team. And what other team did you tag? Maybe NorCal or something like that.
Yeah.
It was funny. It was like all in good fun, right? But it was one of those things where it's like, it was the sport really didn't have a lot of trash talking, right? And it was that kind of initial salvo, like, oh, okay, all right, a little cocky here.
Man, I might have been one of the first CrossFit shit talkers.
You might have been. You might have been. Man. You might have. And now, right, it's got great traction, right? Because right. the guys like Joe Scally and Brent and all those
yep.
guys that do a great job of shit talking.
Well, I'm sad that might have been our first interaction ever, but I didn't push you away too far because here we are, man.
Yeah.
So let's get into some of your journey over the last 10 years. Like I've already started to say, you have one of the largest online communities in CrossFit. You are one of the most successful coaches of all time, but probably most importantly, you are the owner of a very successful chain of CrossFit gyms. And so I think you have a really unique perspective and a lot of wisdom to share for anyone listening that's a business owner, a gym owner, or just someone that, you know, wants to learn. So before you became a coach, I know that you were an attorney at a really prestigious law firm. So maybe you can talk to us about kind of your path to where you got.
Yeah, I I was at a large international law firm. I did securities fraud litigation. It was kind of, you know, every measure of success. I had kind of been able to check that box in terms of going to law school, getting a great job, advancing really, you know, quickly, doing some really interesting work at the law firm. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was intellectually very stimulating. There was always constant challenge with it. But it was really, for me, it wasn't feeding that aspect of like why I was put on this earth, right? I didn't want, you know, I always thought of it in terms of my eulogy and like, well, he did a great job of defending Fortune 500 companies in fraud lawsuits. Right. And it's like, man, that doesn't resonate, right? And not that there aren't a lot of ways that I could have made impact elsewhere, but outside of work, But I had always loved being, you know, with people and helping them make a difference in their lives. And so as I was still an attorney, I found, you know, CrossFit, and I was going to the gym, and by, you know, weird circumstances, the owners of the gym decided to move away. And I basically said, well, just give me the keys. I'll open up. People can train at 6 a.m. with me, right? No intention of coaching or anything. And then after just a couple weeks, right, you see people doing stuff out of the corner of your eye. You're like, man, I got to help this guy, you mm-hmm. know? And so it very quickly turned into me coaching from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., rushing out to the law office, coming back, you know, at 5:45 p.m. and coaching from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., eating some dinner, and then going back to the law office till 1 or 2 in the morning, and then, you know, waking up at 5 and doing it all over again. And I did that for 18 months and kind of got to the point where physically I was killing myself. And I was still trying to get a workout in once in a while and just destroying myself in the process. But I realized, I was like, man, if I'm willing to damn near kill myself for this hobby, I wasn't, you know, it's not like I was getting paid and I didn't need to, I had a great career. But it made me realize I've got to make the jump and just do what I love and figure out if I can make a living at that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't sure. Like, I think people now might look and say, oh, 10 years later, it looks like we've got, you know, a stable business. But at the time, it was 2008. The economy was, it was late 2008. The economy was tanking. And we opened our business at the deepest point of the wow. recession of our generation. And so, so it was, you know, it was one of those things where it was purely driven by passion and understanding that this is what I was, you know, kind of born to do, not necessarily coach CrossFit, but to coach and help people try to be the best that they could be. Mm-hmm. And kind of a cool, you know, story on that is we found after I had been in Open Invictus 5 or 6 years in, we were going through a bunch of stuff in storage and like clearing out some paperwork. And we found like this box that my mom had of all like some of my, you know, my school projects when I was a kid. And we found this seventh grade, like it was your dream job, right? And in seventh grade, my whole dream job, I grew up doing martial arts, was to own a taekwondo facility and take a bus and pick up kids and teach kids taekwondo at a studio.
Get out of here, man.
Yeah, and then like you look and you're like, wow, after going through law school and a legal career and ending up back in a gym where essentially we, you know, are teaching people how to move better and
yeah.
And take better care of themselves. So.
That's cool. Was that the first time you had remembered having that project when you saw
yeah.
that box?
Yeah. I mean, we were just going through some paperwork and like saw it and I was like, wow, that's crazy. You know, it's like my seventh grade drawing of like my even like had a logo and like a bus with the logo on it that I'd pick up kids in. Like,
all, wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That's awesome, man. I have so many questions about that. First, what did your family and kind of friend and support system say about this jump?
Yeah. So that was, it's funny, man. I think that I really relied on my family to hold me back from it. I thought, okay, you know, I'm going way down this path and I'm about to tell my parents like, oh, hey, I'm going to quit this, you know, $250,000 a year job so I can open a gym during the worst recession of my life. And And I thought, well, you know, maybe somebody around me will be like, hey, man, this isn't a good idea. You've worked too hard for your current position. And I told them, and they were like, you absolutely should. Like, you know,
wow.
Because it can't be about the money. It's got to be about what's going to make you happy. And you love helping people. Like, we can tell that you love this. Like, you should absolutely do it. We're behind you 100%. And I was like, oh, damn, things just got real quick.
Wow.
So they were totally supportive, which is amazing. They've remained totally supportive. They're around, you know, my mom and dad both work at the gym. They travel to all these competitions, not all of them, but to the US-based ones, and prep food for all the athletes and do laundry and make sure our athletes are taken care of. So yeah, couldn't ask for a better support network.
So the question, like, what was I put on earth here for? Like, what is my purpose? From my experience and everything I've read, that seems to be a bigger question now than ever before. And I think people that are our parents' age, they didn't tend to ask that question as much. There were, like, industry itself was booming, and people, I think, were much happier just to clock in and out of work. What do you think it is about your parents in particular that made them so supportive? Because I know so many parents that would just be terrified at the idea of their kid jumping ship from an incredibly stable and lucrative career to, you know, jumping into the unknown.
Yeah, I think a few things. One, money, we grew up without much money, right? And that can cut both ways. Like, my parents worked their asses off. Like, they worked all the time to get us into a better situation. And eventually we kind of got that into that better situation. We had six people living in a 900 square foot house. And at some point they decided to move to Oregon, and the cost of living from San Jose to Oregon was, you know, it allowed them to at least get free of debt and some of those things. Right. But, so I say it cuts both ways, because they could have also seen, like, hey, you know, we've worked this hard to get financial security for the family. But they also knew that, kind of in that path, that money was never the driver. And so they didn't want me to stay at a career where it was just, you know, the money, but I wasn't going to have that satisfaction or fulfillment. But I also think in my upbringing, we were very community service based. So my mom and I actually co-founded a charitable organization called Kids Helping Kids back in Oregon that's raised, I don't know, over $10 million, I think,
wow,
at this point, you know, over the course of the years. But and even when we didn't have a lot, you know, I remember my mom's birthday is around Easter, and she didn't want anything. She wanted us to go do a event at Catholic Services, you know, to give back. And so we basically, for her birthday present, did an Easter egg hunt and, like, giveaway at a Catholic Charities, you know, home where family, transitional families were living. And, and so I think that's just always been a big part, is that, you know, there has to be something more, there has to be some give back to the community to make our existence here as optimal as possible.
Right. Yeah, certainly for millennials, and I would suppose even more so for future generations, it's an absolute necessity, just like almost like food, water, shelter, and human connection. It's this deep desire to know that what we're doing is meaningful.
And I think there's a lot of positive in that. And I think there's some drawback, because I do think that some people are trying to find meaning in everything they do. And there was something, you know, so we're also seeing more mental health issues and more anxiety than ever before, because everybody's trying to attribute some greater meaning to every aspect of what they do. And I think that can frustrate me at times too, because I obviously made this jump from lawyer to gym owner and have this great, you know, kind of path to do what I wanted to do. But, there's also nothing wrong. I could have stayed a lawyer and found my impact by doing charitable work or through my family. And
right.
I think people try to tie everything to their job sometimes, where in our parents' generation, I mean, was my dad, you know, stoked about trucking when he was in the trucking industry? No. He was stoked about putting food on the table and working hard and making sure that his family was stable. And then he found his, you know, true why and purpose outside of the hours that he worked. Mm-hmm. Worked hard so that he could do everything else that he wanted to do in his life.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, man. And that's a very similar conversation that I've had with my dad over the years, because he's an attorney. And while he does find some sense of purpose and meaning from his job, he's always told me that there are just so many more hours in the day and so many other ways that you can find meaning in your life. And I picked up this language somewhere along the way that human beings are meaning-making machines, and we just have to watch where we're trying to get that meaning from. So I want to kind of tease out some of the high and low moments over the past 10 years for you. And one thing that I do at dinner parties occasionally is something called Rosebud Thorn. So what's the highlight of your day, the low part of your day, and something that's sort of budding up for you. So I want to do that with your past 10 years, if we can.
Yeah.
So what's been one of the highest points, one of the lowest points, and then what's something that you feel like is currently sort of budding up that you think is going to turn out really positively?
No, that's great. Man, we've had so many highs. It's tough. And the highs have never been around the CrossFit Games or necessarily the competitive side. I mean, those have certainly been cool, and they do wonders for morale in the gym. And but I think the highs have been, you know, these really small moments, right? Like the trajectory of our growth has just been very kind of organic. It hasn't ever really shot up at any time. So I think I've found the most meaning in the small moments of, you know, a client getting, you know, achieving one of their long-term goals, right? Like, and those can be one that sticks out is like, we had a woman that was, you know, over 50 pounds overweight. She was part of our women's kind of weight management clinic. And at some point, right, she was able to put her wedding ring back on for the first time in more than a decade.
Holy shit.
Stuff like that, where that's not a big deal. It's not like, oh, the results, you know, it's not like I'm going to post a before and after testimonial, but it's like what, you know, that did for her confidence, right? That's really cool. And that's why I ended up switching careers. From the business side, I think probably the highlight is I received a letter, and I think this was 2012. Maybe 11, from Peter Vachon, who's a real estate agent out in Missouri that followed our program for a long time. And Peter sent a letter and said, hey, you know, I've been following your program. I'm in the best shape of my life. Gave some numbers that he PR'd on and stuff. He's like, I've got a family and I feel like I've got, you know, a ton of energy for my kids. Just wanted to say thank you. I tried to go on your website and buy a t-shirt and you don't sell anything, so here's a check for $50, right? Like, never nice. Cash the check, still have it, still have the card. And that was a really cool moment, because it was like, it highlighted what an idiot I was in business, right? Because I had never thought to put a Shopify or anything on the store. And that's a large part of our business now is like merchandise and online subscriptions. And so I'm thankful for him pointing that out at an early stage, I guess.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, so those would be the highlights. Man, we've had some deep lows too. And it's really forced me to think, you know, I think that, I don't think it's just me. I think that in our culture, we tend to think, oh, growth is always the goal. Mm-hmm. That bigger is always better. And man, we've taken some lumps. We took a just major hit at the end of 2016. We had to leave our original gym location, and we had just a really rough go of it with the real estate. We finally found a place. It was a really large place, and 35 days before we were set to open and had to be out of our original location, the city came in and said we needed structural engineering, and it was going to be a 6-month delay.
Jesus.
And we were literally put in a position where it was like, figure out a solution or we would suspend business operations. We would literally just have to say like, hey guys, we're going to shut down for 6 months, but come back and see us. Like, which, you know, doesn't work that well in the gym industry.
Right.
And so I had to get real creative real fast. We ended up finding another location that we were able to, it was a CrossFit gym, and we were able to take over their space, knock out a wall, and expand. But in the process, we basically built two 12,000 square foot facilities at the exact same time, which in San Diego, California, is not inexpensive. And I mean, I can tell you very honestly, it almost bankrupted us. Like, it wiped us out because we didn't have the cash reserve. You know, we were $500,000 over what we had budgeted because we had budgeted to build one gym.
Right.
And we ended up building two, and we ended up having to pay way more because of structural engineering and all these things. And so that's, I will say that it's way more uncomfortable to almost fail when you've had years of success than it would have been when we first opened.
And right.
had we first opened and maybe just never gotten traction and said, hey, I don't know financially if this is going to work out. But we had to take a 8-year established business and really make a call. Like, am I willing to put my entire family and livelihood at risk? And, you know, all my properties are on these leases and stuff.
Wow.
And we did, and we fought through it, and it wasn't even the short-term fight. It's the war of attrition, is that stuff doesn't get better overnight. When you've got that kind of debt and you're making large debt payments and stuff like that, you've had to, you know, leverage your line of credit. It's a years long process coming out, and we're just, you know, in 19, we're finally turning the corner of something that happened in October of 16.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's, there have been a lot of times since opening Invictus in the last 2 years that I've had to kind of keep going back to that. Hey, what's my purpose? Why are we doing this? Because, you know, from a pure monetary standpoint, we could have, you know, I could still be a lawyer and not have the stresses of running a business and some of the liabilities that we incur in that.
So before we move on to the bud, first off, thank you so much for your transparency and kind of vulnerability and sharing that, man. In this whole process, have you been able to acknowledge yourself for the courage that it takes to make that decision?
That's a cool question. No, that's really hard for me. I've done a ton of these like personality types. My wife and I have done the 5 languages of love, which I think every couple should at least read once and kind of work through the process. And one of the things is like words of affirmation. Some people love words of affirmation or just getting that. And my wife is one of them, and it's probably the lowest on my priority list. And I explained to her, like, I have almost a visceral reaction when somebody says something like, hey, good job, or you're doing great, or that took courage, or something like that, where I'm like, man, shut up. Like, you know, and it's not because it's just, there's an aspect of like, that's what you're supposed to do. Right. Mm. And I see that as a weakness of mine, is that it is a little bit harder, right? Is that, when you're kind of that type A and just growth minded, like always pushing, I think it's important what you said to actually step back, and I'm terrible at it. And it's been something that, that I'm trying to work on and be better about, to step back and say, hey, actually, like, don't be so hard on yourself, or don't just push through when you've had a good success. And look for the next one.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me be just another person to acknowledge you for the level of commitment that it takes, man. Being an entrepreneur myself, I know the the fear and anxiety that comes with even a bad month. But to go through what you went through takes an just incredible level of commitment to your purpose. So good for you, man.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Actually, this is the first time I've talked about it publicly, but like, I never had trouble sleeping my entire life, right? I didn't sleep a lot, but I would go to bed, I would be out, I would wake up, feel great, right? And man, when all that hit, and there, you know, you hear the old Shakespeare, right? Heavy is the head who wears the crown, and it's all about his inability to sleep, right? And I was like, if you some sleepless nights. No, man, that's paralyzing. Like when you can't sleep and you can't control that process, right? You wake up in the morning, like, what is wrong with me? Like, why can't I just go to bed at night? And it's tough. It has definitely given me a different perspective and probably more empathy for other people, who have gone through similar things.
Right. So what's the bud, man? What's going on right now that's kind of culminating and you think is going to end up really positive?
Yeah, I think for us, it's an expansion on the digital side. We're going to really upgrade our technology, which is the one thing that we've just never focused on. We've been writing programs for 10 years. We've been delivering products, but there's never been any, tech capacity. So we're still operating on like a WordPress blog and it's just gotten to the point where it's like, okay, if we want to continue to deliver the best quality that we can to our athletes and remote coaching clients, we've got to do something about this. And so I'm excited for that. It's going to be a new process. There's probably going to be a lot of ups and downs with it. But we will, we'll make a large upgrade probably before the end of 2019.
Awesome, man. So you're one of, if not the most, you're in one of, if not the most competitive fitness markets in the world. What do you think has separated you and allowed you to remain successful for so long?
Sure. I think we're, as an organization, we've been very committed to education and making sure that we're constantly evolving. But I think, second to that, we've also been really dedicated to giving back, right? And giving away information for free. And I remember Dan John saying that, his best business model was to just keep giving away free stuff and giving away more and more free things. And I think in some ways that's exactly what we've done, right? We started with giving away workouts for free, writing at least 5 blog posts a week that we were publishing that were tried to be substantive posts about like, hey, this is what we're noticing in the gym. This is how to improve this aspect of training, right? Talking about mindsets, changes, and all of the things that we were just as coaches learning and educating our members about. And that's continued to be our model, is what can we share with the rest of the community that might help them? And I think that, we've tried to do that authentically and share what's worked for us. And I think that's resonated with people. They realize that, we're a source that is going to be able to provide credible information.
What piece of advice would you give yourself when you were just starting out?
That's tough, because I think that the advice now that I would look back and I would say, man, you should have been more committed to systems and been more organized. And at the same time, I think that we wouldn't have ever grown if I was committed to systems and being more organized. I was committed to our members first, and then I was committed to our, small coaching staff second, right? When we were really forming, is that I loved being on the floor. I loved doing all the things. Had I been sitting in the office working on, job descriptions and org charts and all that, procedure manuals, like, I just don't think we would have had the organic growth and the love of the community that we had. And so, You know, I don't think I would have changed any of that. But I probably, you know, to step back to our previous conversation, I probably would have encouraged myself to take note of the successes better and actually, you know, celebrate those along the way.
I love that. What leaders or mentors have you modeled most over the years?
I would say from a coaching perspective, Coach Bergner has been just, you know, he embodies what a good coach should be. Not, you know, and I'm not talking about technical coaching at all. Mm-hmm. If you look at the enthusiasm with which he shows up, the genuine care that he, you know, provides for anybody he meets. I mean, we were lucky enough to host his seminars, and at every seminar, like I can't believe he writes his phone number and email address up on the board for this, right? This is a guy that's been,
and there are like 100 people at these things.
Yeah. I mean, and he's been doing this for more than a decade, right? Yep. With all these CrossFitters, and he still gives of himself so freely. But then the other thing that he does, which just blows me away, is at 70, I think Coach is 71 now. You know, Coach shows up at Julian Pino's seminar that we're hosting, and he sits and he takes notes and he learns and he says, gosh, I've been doing that wrong. I think I could do that better. And I'm like, that is the coolest thing in the world. When this coach that I look up to, that I learned so much from, is showing up at the, you know, at any opportunity he can to learn, and is never too, you know, too proud to say, wow, I think I messed that up. I could change something. I could be better at this. Right. And so I think that's always left a huge impact on me, because I, you know, it's such a good life lesson, whether you're in CrossFit or another industry, to always be learning and to always be sharing.
Oh, that's amazing, man. What a unique individual.
Yeah. He's the best. And he can still churn out probably more strict pull-ups than, you know, like any 20-year-old.
Right, right. So talk to me a little bit more about this. One thing you kind of glossed over is his enthusiasm when he shows up. What do you think the value is that in the coach-athlete relationship?
Oh, man, it's huge. And we see it. We see it at all levels. But if you walk into a gym and the coach is like, okay, guys, come on up to the whiteboard. Like, the session is already ruined, right? Mm-hmm. If you walk up into the gym and somebody's like, hey, welcome, like, today is going to be awesome, right? And is excited to be there, and you can tell has something that they're bringing to the table, like, man, it opens up the entire atmosphere, right? Mm-hmm. And coach walks in, like, we always joke that he'll walk into the gym while our guys are training, and I could have said the same thing to him 80 times, you know, whatever. They could be struggling with something for the last 6 months. Coach walks into the gym and he just yells, you know, a couple, you know, hoorahs at him, and they PR. And I'm like, God damn it, coach. But
you're undermining me.
Yeah, I'd kill for that, right? Anytime he comes around, I always tell him, I'm like, you're welcome anytime. You don't have to, you know, ever ask. But every time he comes down, it's, you know, somebody will do something. And we always joke, it's just because he's there and he brings a presence and energy that motivates and inspires people.
Yeah. That's one of the things I regret most about my personal coaching style. I don't coach anyone anymore in CrossFit. And when I was, I think I was so overly focused on, I was focused on two things that I think were of my detriment. One was I was way too focused on flaws and correcting weaknesses rather than highlighting people's strengths and inspiring people to adhere to the program and to stay motivated. And then the second one was I was way more focused on the X's and O's and the science than the art of coaching and actually connecting with people. How do you feel you are on that spectrum, and how specifically do you go about that?
Yeah, I think it's a real balance, right? And I think because I think I've swung both sides and hopefully have, you know, kind of sorted somewhere in the middle. But I remember, and James Fitzgerald also, you know, he's taught me a ton about program design early on. Mm-hmm. I think I was in his very first 2009 you know, his, when he launched his certification programs, and he's been a good friend. But James is very X's and O's, very stoic. And he, you know, he and I had a conversation where he's like, dude, you'll kill yourself if you ride the emotional highs and lows with your athletes. Mm-hmm. And I don't disagree with that. And yet I'm, you know, I do kill myself riding those highs and lows because right. I don't think it's in my nature to totally separate that. But, you know, I've also tried to get deep into the, you know, kind of the science and physiology. And at the end of the day, I've had some athletes that just aren't happy in their training. Right. And so it's like, we, like even at our gym, we train in a group, right? So all of our games athletes, we're all following a similar template and we're trying to get them to work as often as possible. Now, as a pure strength and conditioning coach, could I put them all on, you know, totally different templates? Yeah. But then we would lose any benefit of training together that we can get, mm-hmm. right? And that's what I think has, you know, proven to be the most helpful for our longevity, is that athletes are still having fun. They still like coming right. to the gym. They still like training together. And so I think there's a real balance there of, you know, how do you give the individual athlete exactly the tweaks that they need, but also keep them motivated, keep them in an environment where they're being pushed by others. And that most importantly, that they have a social network that they're having fun engaging with.
Right. I think this is one of the lesson you just taught is one of the most frustrating thing in the world, frustrating things in the world for someone who looks at everything through the lens of science. With that said, there's this guy named Eric Helms, who's in the bodybuilding community, that wrote he built these two pyramids. It's a nutrition pyramid and a muscle and strength pyramid. And at the bottom of both pyramids, the most important thing is either compliance or adherence to the program. If it could be the most perfect program in the world, but if they're not having fun, if they're not motivated and they're not sticking to it, then it's a completely shitty program. So I love that you're putting all of that intention into actually getting people to stick to the program.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, I've made a lot of mistakes along the way.
Right. Right.
And
right.
At times I was so, you know, just adamant that they stick to their program and not, you know, mess around and train with other people. And so I've learned, you know, the hard way on some of those and had to back off.
Right. So speaking of kind of the emotional highs and lows and getting burnt out, I know that you're putting more intention into your own self-care. What's behind that and what are you doing?
Yeah, just recently, but I've had a real hard time, you know, over the years. I've got a growing family. I've got, you know, a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old and then the growing business. And so what I've found is that as things got busy and as people, you know, I had more people and with greater needs, I tended to, you know, I'd put my own needs last, right? Especially as it came to health and fitness. And so I also realized that if my health and fitness isn't on point, then I'm not going to have the energy. I'm not going to be able to lead in the way that I want to lead. And so I'm fighting back from a lot of years of sacrificing too much on that. And it's tough, man. It's tough to especially beat the mental comparisons of knowing, oh, well, I used to be able to do this.
Right.
And so, you know, along that whole, the way I try to empathize as much as I can with our gym members, right, who are normally in that boat and normally not coming at this from, you know, a competitive aspect or always been healthy my whole life aspect.
Right. I find it really interesting whenever I go any period of time without where I don't prioritize my health and fitness, when I'm starting to get back into it, I sort of feel like I'm taking a step back in my career or my other interests and my other priorities. But what I found over and over and over is kind of what you already said, which is that it gives me more energy. It gives me more intensity to bring to all of those other things. So it's really not a step back at all. It just allows me to show up greater in all of the things that matter to me.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely right. That's been my experience. It's still the emotion that I struggle with, which is if I leave the house to work out right at 5:30 in the morning, then I'm not here when the kids wake up to help my wife. Or, you know, if I try to work out at lunch, then I'm missing, you know, a block of the day where I'd be in meetings with an employee or, you know, right, like that. And yet I know, and I've got, you know, I do have a great support network that people mm-hmm. want me to make sure I get that in. You know, sometimes too much so, especially at the gym, because when some of your coaches or athletes want you to join them, it's normally going to be a very cruel punishment right. that I'm going to receive at that point.
Ooh.
Yeah, right?
Yes. All right, man. So my final question for you is, what advice do you think 70-year-old CJ would give you in this chapter of your life?
Oh, probably to probably slow down, right? Take some things off the plate so that I can actually spend more, you know, give more to the things that need to be on it.
Yeah.
I've just, you know, just had a habit of saying yes to darn near everything and wanting to give everything I've got to everything. You know, and that goes for family, right? Is that like, I'm not going to let my kids down. So I'm trying to make sure I can drop off at school and, you know, be at certain events and all of that kind of takes a toll when you've also got a lot of work responsibilities. And so I think really clarifying what needs to be done and what doesn't need to be done and, you know, putting full focus only on the things that absolutely need to be done.
I love that, man. I go back to the Tony Robbins quote often of, we overestimate what we can do in a year and underestimate what we can do in 10, or we underestimate what we can do in 50. Right? Like what really is the rush? And if we're continuously rushing through our lives, then we might achieve a lot more, but we won't get to enjoy any of it. So that's great advice, 70-year-old CJ.
Yeah.
Well, man, we did it again. I just want to thank you for your time and for the stand that you're taking in your local community, as well as the global community that you are influencing, man. You're making a really big impact.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate you having me on and love everything you've been up to.
Thank you, man. Where can people find out more about you?
Just CrossFitInvictus.com and then our social channels, which are some form of that, or CFInvictus.com, something like that. I'm terrible about the social stuff. So if you type in CrossFit Invictus, you'll find us.
Awesome, man. Thank you, brother.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.